So I found the interviews very helpful, just because I just make a whole range of suggestions, which some I use, some I've seen other people use, and just seeing that some of, you know, the responses, how some of the suggestions make people too tight, some of the suggestions work, the same suggestion works for one person, not for another person. So just in general, just the fact that I make a suggestion, you try and it doesn't work, means you're developing the capacity for reflection, seeing cause and effect, which is karma, seeing what works for you, and hopefully building up some confidence in who you are and what you want to do with the meditation work. So it was very fruitful interviews, I found. I don't know about you, but... but I did receive some bad news in the end. It seems that longevity is from the matrilineal line. This has changed my game plan.
No, can you?
Mom lived to be 96. Gran was 93. So the first thought was, I better do my yoga. It's interesting, just that, you know, the perception of time, self, future, change, those kinds of things. And all you can really know is that it begins and ends. And that's the mystery of awareness, is that it doesn't begin and end. It seems like you get lost and so on, but, you know, have you ever not been present, even in your wildest daydreams? There's always a sense of presence there. And that ineffable presence is what I think, you know, spiritual life is about. And then our social life is how to, you know, how to live a good life, how to be a good person. And what was the one that Jack, the beautiful one that a Singaporean had said, we have 26 beings. Jack, tell me again.
When we descend to earth, when we're born, we come as a package of 26 souls. And our purpose in life is to find all 26 and eventually help them to become enlightened. And when you do, you all return to the source. But within that group, that there's one individual, they're all soulmates, but one individual is usually of the opposite sex, and they represent your missing half. It's not necessarily a sexual partner, it's the missing half. So find our missing lights and missing souls.
Nice one, huh? So ask them, how many I got left? I think Mom was my other half. So there's different ways to kind of interpret the purpose of life. So for me, there's the conventional reality of living in society and trying to do things in a decent way, and then using that societal situation I'm in to realize a spiritual part of my life. And both are important. Both are important. To live a good and true life in a meaningful way in society, I think for me is very important. So we, at tea time, you know, Kim and I were just talking about that he was talking about his mom's interested in meditation, his stepdad and brother, and so it's very rewarding. And I said, well, that's our social activism. We're kind of insidiously getting into the culture. Mm-hmm. And it is, isn't it? It's a kind of activism. It's not maybe political activism or ecological activism. It's just heart activism. And we can all do that through... And the best way we can do that is by understanding our own minds. I mean, it's a cliche, but it's true. It's true, isn't it? The more I understand fear, the more I can talk about fear with other people, the more I understand the various complexities of social relationships and how you use them as Dhamma, the more I can share that. So, again, it's a cliche, but I think it's the biggest gift we can give to society is to be wise. And the way we can be wise is by understanding our suffering. So it's not selfish, and a retreat is not easy. you know, that's kind of, we call it a retreat, but actually it's, you're not running away from anything, are you? You're right there looking, being with the body, being with the mind. So my hope is to really just to encourage people. So what I offer is from my own experience and from what I've talked with people, and if the hat fits, wear it. But just to be encouraged in that, in the contemplative part of our life, in that part which is curious about consciousness and curious about our conditioning and interested in transcendence. I mean, these are obviously important themes for me. Conventional culture, it's hard to talk about transcendence. Like, transcendence already sounds like transcendental meditation, and you're going to be up with the, you know, the master in the sixth realm of the 14th heaven of the eighth dimension or whatever. So there's that. So even language of liberation, Nibbana, is again, it's a kind of nirvana perfume, but there is something, isn't there? There is something other. Theistic language doesn't work for me, but certainly that's the Western cultures use theistic language, but to me the sense of other is entered through awareness. It is awareness, really. And to trust in that and to explore that means that we have to stop being preoccupied with the conditioned realm. And that's the challenge, to be in the conditioned world, to be with the conditions of our social responsibilities, limitations of our body, our own human conditioning, to be in all that and yet not of that. It's the adages that we have. Interesting challenge. So let's see what the old... You've been drinking coffee? Okay. Dreaming. I have lucid dreams. Often, but never for a solid week. Do you think there is a correlation between meditation and dreaming, or is it more likely the lack of stress which allows for deeper sleep and more vivid dreams? I think, for me, it's just an opinion, but I think awareness... we were saying, like, in the last meeting, I think, that the masters I've read that I like say that enlightened being is aware through deep sleep, dreaming, and wakefulness. And that to me makes sense, because awareness could not blank out. It's just their identity with self, with body, with the senses prevents that realization. So I think that, again, it's just an opinion, but I think that because we are practicing awareness very deliberately when we're on a retreat, I think that awareness becomes more sustained, and then awareness functions through the dream state. And hence, I think we can recollect dreams. Again, that's just my opinion. In terms of dreams and so on, Theravada Buddhism has very little like dream work. You don't find that kind. You find the Buddha having prophetic dreams. You hear about Ajahn Chah having kind of like, Ajahn Sumedho had sort of three prophetic visions about going to the West. Which, you know, were quite interesting. So you do hear about visions and things. Ajahn Chah had something too about the Sangha being in the West. Those are kind of extraordinary things. But in terms of the work that people do in Western culture about dreaming, I've never come across anything in Theravada Buddhism about that. So personally, I think the dream world's just fine the way it is. It's working out what I'm doing in daily life. But what I try to be very aware of is the tone of mind as I wake up. Because if I've had a troubled sleep or a troubled dream, then the tone of the mind is obviously conditioned by that. And I try to really, really be very aware of that and not carry it into the day, and try to come to the heart and enter into the day in a kind of heartfelt purity. Not purity, but heartfelt centeredness, I suppose. anatta? How can we reconcile personality and characteristics with anatta? Perhaps we need an entire retreat on anatta. It's a very difficult concept, but it's a way of trying to perceive the flow of nature as including the flow of mental formations and bodily formations. So getting a, and yet also being, seeing that there is a personal component to the flow of consciousness, and it's not that there's nothing, but that the flow, like what the word we use to replace self in Buddhism is dependent origination. So rather than there being a fixed self, a me who's experiencing all this, there's certainly awareness, and these things are traveling through awareness. And so the anatta teaching is that the anatta teaching doesn't say that there's no self. You know, when we read that chant, it didn't say there's no self. It said that the form is not me, not mine. Feeling is not me, not mine. Perception is not me, not mine. Mental formations, not me, not mine. And consciousness, those are through the sense fields, not me, not mine. So it's, that's one of the misunderstandings in Western interpretations of that, there's no self, which isn't what the teacher says, because if there was no self, it sounded like there's nothing, but there is something, there's consciousness, there's presence, there's awareness. And so what the teaching of anatta is trying to do, and then that's conjoined with dependent origination, the teacher samuppada, and that is basically saying, with this as condition, that arises. When there's this, there's that. With this not as condition, that does not arise. When there's not this, there's not that. So that's what it's just pointing to, that the feeling of being on, like you have a good meditation, right? It all kind of clicks along, the insights just roll, you know, emptiness just kisses your cheek and you're all just rolling along and you think, wow, I'm really doing well. And that sense of I arises because of a causal condition, because of a seemingly successful meditation. Next day you sit down, you know, it's a complete tip in your mind. Everything's falling apart, you know, my meditation's down the tube. I am hopeless. I can't meditate. Depends. So the sense of I is something that's dependently originated. But the awareness of that is not dependently originated. We'd say the awareness is something different because it's not caused in the same way. It's not like a color or an emotional feeling. So by perceiving that which arises and ceases as that, and abiding as awareness of change or awareness of the perception of not self, you begin to see the vibrant, solid nature, the refuge of awareness, and you begin to find refuge in that. But that doesn't dismiss the very personal characteristics of you know the ache in your back or your family conditioning or the fact that you have to pay the mortgage and make sure the car has winter tires on it and all that's going on. So it's a kind of twofold way. So in our monastic discipline, the sense of self is used in the Vinaya. So the Vinaya is my monastic responsibility as a social being. So that's where I am Virodhamo, and I have my responsibilities, and I have my email address, and da 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 da. And then within that what we call conventional reality, there is this awareness which notices change. And so both are important. If you didn't have both, you wouldn't have Buddhism. But the point of the Vinaya, our monastic training, is not to develop an identity, I am a monk, and I am a senior monk, because that would be ego, but rather to have a vehicle to travel in, you know, a good enough vehicle. It doesn't have to be Mahayana. It can be a little one. And it's good enough to watch, you know, so it's a Volkswagen. Fine. And you watch, you know, how like, dislike. So say, like we were talking about the chanting. So one person was saying they kind of, they like the Pali, but they don't understand it, so they like the translation, but they don't like the English. So that happens to every monk, you know, oh, this Pali chanting, I want polyphonic chanting, you know, I want Gregorian chant, or oh, the Tibetans, they have real chanting. So like, if you think you got the perfect vehicle, you're in trouble, right? You know, I got to switch vehicles now, get a new steering wheel. But no, it's this vehicle, and the chanting is sometimes okay, sometimes you like it, sometimes you don't like it. And you watch like and dislike, because you have this lovely vehicle you're traveling in, and you begin to find freedom within within the travel, rather than always needing an upgrade in your vehicle, or getting car seats, or little bangles, or a special license plate, or whatever you want. So in Buddhism, so like in traditional Buddhism, there were three kind of vehicles. There's vocation, there's family, and there's monasticism. And so vocation and family can be conjoined, and these are the vehicles that you travel in. Your duty to children, and or your duty to your vocation. And then within that traveling, the point in traditional societies was not that you find fulfillment just through the vocation of family, but that the family is a vehicle within which you can serve, you can surrender, and understand the transcendent. That's sort of the traditional way of it. So anatta is obviously the most difficult concept we have in Buddhism. It's not easy. We all struggle with it. But remember, it's not saying there's no self. It's just that which has a nature to rise has a nature to cease, and because it's changing, you won't find a fixed commodity called me in it. It's changing, so don't grasp it. Don't identify with it. It's not to be grasped. It's certainly misconstrued by when who was the Polish Pope? Paul was it?
Yep.
He wrote one of his books about his summation of all religions. Thanks. And so he said Buddhism was nihilistic, right? And he totally didn't understand. He said, well, what about transcendence? What about nirvana? What about the unconditioned, the uncreated? You know, Meister Eckhart talks like that. Well, but he, you know, from his viewpoint, the very teaching of anatta was nihilistic or whatever. And we Buddhists didn't like that. A question regarding the Anattalakkhana Sutta. Oh, here we go again. How can you talk about the line, is it fit to consider that which is impermanent, painful, of a nature to change, as this is mine, I am this is myself? What is meant by it is fit to? Like, is it correct? Is it correct to talk about something which is impermanent as something that I own? And the Buddha said, well, you don't really own it, because if you owned it, you could control it. You get rid of it when you want, you make it bigger or smaller, you don't really own it. But it's a part of your kind of karma that you're living through it. So the sense of ownership would be incorrect, but through application of mind, you can certainly create results in that. So through the application of mind, I can create results in the mental stream. Certainly, well, that can be done. And so there is a kind of ownership, and that ownership is karma. And the idea of Buddhism is to go beyond karma. So you create good karmic causes to get to the point, which is very difficult, of no effort, of no volition, like totally. So all volition is karmic. And then that kind of last step of enlightened being is the mind is so pure, there's no more volition. And that's a mystery, how that works. And all mystical traditions talk about that. You talk about Rumi or Meister Eckhart. They all come to that point, can't do anything. And St. John of the Cross has that lovely gradation. It's all about nothing, 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 nothing. In the high, we were talking about one of the groups, the highest realization is poverty. You own nothing, you have nothing, you are nothing. And that kind of language is really kind of confusing until you begin to see that any grasping of the khandhas always takes you into an attribute, takes you into a thing which is changing, and you change with it. And just through a kind of receding attitude, you begin to find that, yeah, awareness, hanging with awareness, that's really peaceful. But it's a peace which is not dependently originated. So it's a kind of catechism that the Buddha gives to his monks, just to try to get them to not grasp, not create self-identities. So where do I create self-identities? Maybe mistakes I've made, my body. That's a really strong self-identity, isn't it? It's my knees and so on. And yet, when you just stop and notice, and you let go of my knee, it's just heat, pressure, pain, just that. It's not pleasant, maybe. But then that this is my body is added to it. And like when we do body meditation, like someone is saying, they feel their hands, and that's a very, you know, very neutral. And it's, then all of a sudden the sense of hands goes. It's just sensation. It's not a me doing it. It's just sensation. And the suggestion I make, like listen to sound, feel the body. It's a very good exercise. Listen to sound, feel the body. Notice that they're just both formations in nature. The self-identity comes afterwards. And those are I think, very pragmatic exercises which help you go beyond just kind of trying to figure it out intellectually. You know, experientially, I find that really, really helpful. Just like pain in the knee, sound of the boiler. I do that a lot. Pain in the knee, sound of the boiler. See, they're both, but they're just objects changing. And you get that perspective in awareness. So the sense of awareness is the thing that contains everything, but it's not everything. A mystery that way. Mm-hmm. I'm glad someone wrote. I don't know what I would have talked about today. On Tuesday, you explained that you practiced selective ordination. In that you would not ordain a person who could not get along with their family, okay, who simply could not work, but you would ordain someone who wished to attain nirvana. This implies that this is a path which can reliably lead to nirvana. On the following evening, you responded to a question which asked essentially how reliability by suggesting the questioner just go to the pub. However, could you please explain a seemingly paradoxical approach to two different beings' aspirations for nirvana, preferably before closing time? Thank you. Well, sometimes I'm just totally facetious because I just cannot say so many serious things in a row. So I just need comic relief. So forgive me. No, if someone wants to ordain, first of all, the whole community has to accept them. It's not my choice. I'm the sponsor. As a upachaya or preceptor, I would sponsor a candidate. But the candidate would then have to be approved by anyone. So if someone came to me and they wanted to be in an agarika, first of all, I'd say, well, let me think about it. And I'd ask the whole community. And the whole community would say, well, not yet, or okay. So if that approval came, then the person would be an anagarika for a year, and then they would ask me, I'd like to be a samanera, which Venerable came as a samanera, which is the second stage of novitiate. And then I'd say, well, yeah, maybe, let me think about it. And I'd ask the community, and then we'd all talk about it. And if the community thought, yeah, okay, then the anagarika could ordain as a samanera, and then after another year, the samanera could ask to be a bhikkhu, which is the full ordination. And then I'd say, well, okay, I'll be your upachaya, but let me check with the community. I'd ask the community. The community said, no, not yet. Let's wait another 4 months and let's see. So someone would have doubts in the community. And then we'd talk it over. Why? I'd say, why? Well, you know, there was this, you didn't see this. Oh, yeah, okay. Because I sometimes don't see things. Go to the candidate and say, well, not yet. And the candidate would have to wait until the whole community felt that, okay, the person's ready for ordination. So qualifying for ordination is also kind of qualifying in a way that one is simpatico with the community, because otherwise it could never work. It would just be too difficult. So the person has to have enough social skills and respect for those who are in the order to be accepted into the order. Otherwise it would never work. And then the criteria for the ordination, if it was not for the realization of a nibbana, and the person wasn't really interested in Theravada Buddhism, I would really question their going the distance. I mean, most men don't go the distance. Most men stay for a while in the disrobe, right? I'm a lifer. but the whole intention, like let's say if someone came, well, you know, it's hard to get employment. I like to meditate. So, you know, good food. Thai meal every now and then. Not a good reason. Or because they wouldn't last. That's not if they were just there because of the teacher, that's also not a good criteria, because eventually the teacher becomes unpleasant to their perception. Joan Halifax, she has a phrase, she says, first of all, they idolize me, then they demonize me, and then they normalize me. Mm-hmm. But usually they've left by the demonic stage. So, you know, to you know, when one comes into the order because of a teacher, when that disillusionment comes, and it always comes, oh, wow, I didn't realize he was like that. It's like marriage, I suppose, huh? I'm not sure. Oh, you're like that. I mean, the person's never changed, of course, but the perceptions have changed. Now, if the person is ordaining for the realization of Nibbana, then disappointment is not a problem. It's just another sankhara. But if the person's ordaining because of some naive sense that the teacher will always, you know, nail it on the head and be sensitive and all the rest of it, the community will always be harmonious and the food will always be good, whatever. Then when disappointment comes, the person, because they've ordained for an ulterior reason, a worldly reason, they can believe in their disappointment and leave, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But if they've ordained for the realization of Nibbana, the teacher can say, it's just Vedana. You know, it's just Sankhara. That's all it is. And there's not much of a rejoinder there. And if the person's sincere about Nibbana, then they can bear with the disappointment. And so that's kind of very important. I forget why I said the pop, so apologies about that. Naughty, naughty, very dumb. You mustn't go to the pub. Okay. Could you please explain what is meant by self-torture as one of the two extremes to avoid? So, Attakilamatana Yoga and Sukhalikana Yoga, they're kind of two yogas. Attakilamatana Yoga is self-mortification. So it comes in the time of India, probably, you know, from the various ascetics that lived, probably also from Jainism, because the Jain monasticism started before Buddhist monasticism, and there is a lot of speculation that the Buddha's modeling of the monastic tradition came somewhat from the Jain tradition. And the Jain tradition has a very, very ascetic ethos, so much so that in Buddhist sense it would be to be self-mortification in terms of denying food, denying comfort, denying warmth to the body. But also, the Buddha practiced the ascetic practice, as you know the story, for 6 years, they say. We speculate, he says in the books, and there he denied himself sleep, he tried to hold his breath, he fasted, he got so weak that he almost died. So that is one of the ways that ascetics in India and in later on in the West thought that you could become enlightened by denying the body any of its needs, not just desire, its needs. And so through some kind of willful suppression, the soul would be released, or there would be moksha in some way. So that was a very prevalent philosophy, and the Buddha tried that. And if you think about it, you know, he tried, if that's accurate, the timing of that, you know, maybe 1 or 2 years he's doing like meditation practices, and then he goes off and does these ascetic practices for so long, you wonder what in that culture in him made him do that for so long. And then he saw, well, I'm going to die if I do this. So it comes to some extent from that extreme of asceticism, which existed in monastic communities already. In Christianity, you had the the lactites, really, the ones that sat on platforms. They were really, they were wonderfully weird. They just lived on platforms. That's another retreat. We won't try that this retreat. Stalactites or stalagma, or something like that. But for us, you know, for us, what would that mean? It's the extreme of like this willful practice of just like, I'm going to conquer my pain. You know, like all of us probably tried that in the beginning. I'm just going to sit through pain. So we thought it's a big deal. Did your knees in and got no wisdom from it. I didn't get any wisdom from it. The only wisdom I got was that is an extreme, which won't work. So one is the extreme in sensual participations and so on. The other is the extreme of trying to suppress things, get rid of them and become. And both are a preoccupation with willpower. One is through indulgence and the other is through that. So I guess in what would you call it in modern psychology, would it be suppression? Maybe those kinds of things. Self-disparagement would probably come into that. All those kind of mind states. Yeah, so you might have, the question might have narratives of self-torture. And that would be, where you're just always castigating yourself. Yeah, you moved in the 55th minute. There's an hour sitting and you moved at 59. You're awful. You had a terrible, this kind of horrible, tyrannical voice that we all have experienced. And to believe that would be a kind of mental self-mortification. And so the teaching is always this, like, there is a kind of fierceness in the Buddha's. If you look at the Buddha, he was a fierce practitioner. He didn't mess about, but in the end, he found a balance. He found a balance through the mistakes he made, and certainly he encouraged a kind of vigor, but always through investigation. So all the suggestions about kindness, loving kindness, they're very powerful. But it's a reflective teaching rather than a willful teaching. I mean, we need willpower. It's not about willing ourselves into enlightenment. It's an understanding what that means. So it's a wisdom teaching. Do you have any advice for us on how to continue and keep it up? Will it take many years of meditation to reach samadhi stage? Well, again, I think just be humble and say, okay, this is what I got to work with. And oh God, this is what I've got to work with. Just okay, this is the project, these mind states, this family conditioning, this body, and I'm just gonna try to be at peace with it. Just that simple. I'm just gonna try to peacefully coexist with my bodily states and my mental states. And then why am I not at peace with this? And how could meditation make me more attentive to that? And how could meditation release some of the attitudes that I have which cause me so much problem? So if you take just a kind of really humble attitude or not complicated attitude, then the samadhi or the meditative peacefulness, you'll discover your own ways of doing that, I think, I think the most important thing is that you stop. You just kind of get a space in your schedule, and you stop and look at it. So how is life now? And it's not much. And then do things like yoga and Tai Chi and going for walks with your dog or things like that, where you just give yourself time to ponder life. Just to think about what happened today. Just that natural reflective part, get that going, and then the meditation is very, very helpful for that. I think it's important to give time for the mind to empty out, because we're always feeling, aren't we? I was thinking our kind of data knowledge culture, exponential, doubling every 2 minutes or something. The vast amount of knowledge which comes at us, and a lot of it's very interesting. I've got my iPad and. We did the Talmud I detailed them. I said, what's the Talmud? No, more information. Right. First five, it's the first five chapters of the Old Testament. Big deal. Another factoid in my mind. But what I really like is actually silence. You know, isn't that the most beautiful thing? I just silently look at those two buildings. I think, that's lovely architecture. And so the most beautiful thing in our lives is sort of not recognized in our culture because we're so busy with our Wikipedia or whatever. And it's not that it's bad, it's not evil. So I think time to empty out, time to do nothing, a data fast. Once a week, a data fast. Right? Data. No data. and just like giving the mind a chance to rest and to look at a tree. Yeah, those are cliches, but they're true. Aren't they? They're very true. Give the mind just to empty out. Even like Buddhist study can just become like you're just getting more information. That can be quite a hang-up. They kind of think, well, if I study more. I know my dad used to kind of say, you know, the more you read, the more you'll know. And then when I got into monasticism, the first time I came back and talked to him about emptiness, he said, impossible. He totally rejected it. That's not possible. It's just such a foreign territory for him. Yeah, so, you know, times of not doing, not becoming, not... And I know it's a cultural thing, but to make looking out the window important. Right? Just this, those kinds of things. And that's really very reflective. All right, come to the monastery. Make you work a lot. I continue to be perplexed by the discourse on the characteristics not self. Wow. We'll have to do a retreat. Why? For form, for example, to use self, we would need to have the power to change at will. If the self existed, would it be all-powerful, changing from feeling, perception, May I suggest with this, because it's a similar kind of question, rather than just trying to figure out, just applying that perception, can I suggest that? Just apply, you know, as like especially if your mind is revving up a lot of self-narratives, say, a lot of self-stories about something, historical or future. What happens if you put that in the mind? Not me, not mine. And then rather than trying to figure out not self as a philosophy, but what happens if you just do that perception and then come to me in a year's time? Really, right? Like give it a go and see, is there a result from that? If not, I'll give you your money back. A year.
No, I didn't understand what you're suggesting to do.
When the self views come up, a narrative about something, right? And the story comes up. Look at it and say, not me, not mine. Mm-hmm. Just that. See what happens. Each time it comes, not me, not mine. My body, say, bodily thing. So pain starts to hurt, not me, not mine. See what it does to your awareness and perception system. Because that's what I feel with some of these questions. Because it is a very difficult sutta. And I think it'd be more profitable to try to. When you ponder it, it does make logical sense and so on, and it fits dependent origination and so on. But if you're having trouble processing that, let it also just like sleep on it. Let those questions be questions that guide your inquiry. It's a good thing to question that. It's very, very good. And let don't try and answer it right away. Just let the question just sit for a while, and see what comes out of that. And both would be helpful. But I think I sort of maybe I hadn't covered it very well. I feel like I don't want to know too much about all the negative things happening in the world: Ebola, wars, terrorism, etc. I don't avoid the news entirely, but severely limit the time I spend listening to CBC radio, and I never watch TV. Is this skillful, or am I trying to avoid the emotional reactions this material brings up? Should I watch more and just try to be mindful of the fear, etc.? No, don't watch. Right, you know, let someone else take care of that. If you're the President of the United States, you probably have to watch CNN or something. Right? But in general, I think it's very important to practice sense restraint. And that's one of the basics of our trainings, Indriya Samvara. Indriya Samvara and Santuti. Santuti is contentment, a little. And Indriya Samvara is sense restraint. And that's a very important form of sense restraint. If you find that any of the sense doors causes you agitation, and you have a choice not to engage in those sense doors, the Buddhist teaching is don't go there. Don't go there. If you have to, you have to. Sure, you know, if you have to. Some people aren't so you know, they're not troubled by that so much. Others are, but definitely it's good. Yeah, it's like not filling your mind with garbage, isn't it? Just like not eating junk food. It's the same kind of thing. So definitely. Don't feel that you have to save the world. Right? If you can offer a little old lady a hand across the street, that's better than watching 4 hours of CNN. Right? That's more effective for world peace, I think. How do I release cravings? Just by being mindful of the body sensations associated with them, combined with intention? Or are there better ways? I think familiarity with your patterning, and then body awareness, and then a kind of purity of attention, that you're not trying to get rid of it, because it's very hard not to try to get rid of something which you don't want, and it's very hard just to allow something to go through you in a way where you're not rejecting it but not indulging it, which is the middle way of non-indulgence and non-aversion. So I say non-becoming, non-resistance. So that's a learned thing. You know, that's a learned thing. Some cravings are very, very strong. So like for my mom, she smoked till she was 80. And I asked her when she was 92, I think the last time I asked her, after a meal, would you like a smoke? She said, yeah. Didn't give it to her. But I said, wow, is that strong? That's strong, that kind of craving. So a craving can still be there, but you don't have to follow it. You don't have to follow it. So if a craving is very... Quite often the cravings we have are to get rid of things. You know, to get rid of craving for something. Quite often they're very hidden, and so on. So body awareness, and then all kinds of attitudes of renunciation and compassion and kindness. Those attitudes build up more awareness and strength of character to be with the cravings. Sometimes you'll get like a, you know, some kind of volcanic eruption of material from childhood or something like that, right? Which, where did that come from? And then that craving could be very strong to, you know, there's something wrong. I thought I got through that. There's nothing wrong. It's just old, like I say, old gas coming through. It's a bad smell for a while. And the craving mind will think there's something wrong. There's nothing wrong. You know, that's where self-identity comes in. You know, if you see the khandhas as khandhas, it's just natural formations, and you really see not self, you won't take it personally. But if some old material comes up, and you think, oh God, I thought I got through that. I am someone who got through that. I have a certain level of attainment, and this is not right. Self-view, born-again Buddhist. But do have a look at Ajahn Sumedho's book, Don't Take It Personally. For those who were questioning the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, it really hammers away at that personality view. Don't take your life personally. How many people have I recommended that, right? Could you provide the cultural reference for stabbing a tomato with a fork and declaring it dead? No, it's too embarrassing. That's so complicated.
Can you read the question again?
I can't even. We have rules. And some of the rules are not totally logical. And those rules are to test our attachment to logic. And this is one of them that presses our logic buttons. Now, they weren't invented for that. They were invented at the time of the Buddha to cover certain contingencies which do not exist today. And so we are still not morally bound by them, but as a kind of mindfulness practice. So there was the feeling in the time of the Buddha that there were one faculty consciousness, such as plants. And one faculty consciousness should not be damaged, which came from the Jain tradition. So a Jain monk can eat wheat, but not a turnip, because wheat grows again, whereas a turnip would die. Okay? So you're killing one faculty consciousness. That's just for complexity. So then, for some reason, I can't even remember how it comes in the rules, we had to somehow, I think the Buddhists were trying to accommodate the various religious views at the time, because much of our Vinaya is so that the lay people don't lose faith. So it's kind of accommodating different views that the lay people have. And part of that was that if there are any plants with seeds, that they should be made allowable. So we have a little ceremony where we stab fruit or vegetables with live seeds and we make it allowable. Now, for me, it's one of those rules that I have to watch my mind, because I think this is ridiculous. And it's actually quite good for that, because my mind wants everything logical and rational, right? And so then, like when I was a younger monk, I'm not doing this. And who cares if I do it? The other monks don't care if I do it. It's not a moral rule. It's just a rule of etiquette. So then I'd just be huffing. I know better than the Buddha, never made that rule. And then I'd feel like a complete idiot. Right? It's like proud. I just stab the damn thing. It's going to be all right. You just do it. And then it becomes that you're just mindful. You're mindful of the food that's offered. It's just okay, that needs that. And it just becomes a little ritual, a little ceremony where everybody becomes mindful. The lay people who become mindful, we become mindful. But it's tortured me a little bit. Please don't ask that question again.